You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. How do we deal with lawbreakers when cultural issues shape their behavior, perhaps their path to this behavior, whether they're adults or children? Looking especially at a juvenile delinquents, is incarceration a relic of the past, or is it still a necessity? When are community-based alternatives better than a more institutional approach? With me in the studio tonight, I have Richard Halpern, the managing attorney of the juvenile program for the private defender program of the San Mateo County Bar Association, James Wade, assistant San Mateo County District Attorney. James recently completed an assignment as deputy in charge of the juvenile division and has moved onward and upward with the within the San Mateo County District Attorney's Office. And Dr. Gregory Tanaka. Dr. Tanaka is a former juvenile defense attorney with the Office of the Public Defender in Honolulu, Hawaii, has also moved on, is a law professor, has his PhD in education and anthropology. Dr. Tanaka is a co-founder, and correct me if I get this wrong, Anamatangi Polynesian Voices, a community organization created to teach language and culture and revitalization to Polynesian youth in East Palo Alto, promote mental health, along with faith, teach and apply skills in leadership and civic engagement. While our discussion may be centered around incarceration issues, please call us with any juvenile delinquency questions you may have. If you have questions for my guests, our number to us in this studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, you can call us toll-free. We'll pay the freight, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. But before we begin, I'm pleased to once again announce the return of Call a Lawyer Night tonight. If you have questions for Call a Lawyer, that number that will not place you on the air is 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. And this will not put you on the radio. And tonight, we have a fairly full house of lawyers standing by to answer your legal questions, whether it's on the air or off the air. We include both first-time participants and long-time supporters of Call a Lawyer, including Frank Adam, who's there to answer your questions about tax law, real estate law. He is both a CPA and a real estate broker, as well as an attorney, with patent law, aviation law, lemon law, BBB arbitration. We have Ron Rohde from Palo Alto answering your questions on criminal law, those that are not directed to us on the air. We have David Bigelizen of San Francisco. With your landlord-tenant questions, we have Jessica Chilek from San Francisco. From family law, we have Janet Frankel, certified specialist, also from San Francisco. Also available to give you guidance, bankruptcy lawyer Leon Bayer, a certified specialist in bankruptcy law. And again, if you want a consultation off the air, that's a private call, 800-KALW-917. If you're calling for us on the air, please call us with any juvenile delinquency questions you might have. With your questions for my guests, direct them to here in the studio at 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of San Francisco, again, that's 866-798-8255. And with that, let me welcome you, Rick, James, Greg. Welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello. Hello.
I'd like to start with this. We've heard talk of localities that are thinking maybe it's time to close down the juvenile hall, maybe it's not. I guess my first question is it really time? Is it time to end incarceration altogether?
So I think that that is where the juvenile law is heading. The you use the term, I think, therapeutic detention, which is a term they use in place of incarceration in at least the juvenile courts in San Mateo County. And I think the science today is clearly showing that there's very little therapeutic about detention. And I recognize there are public safety issues and concerns that have to be addressed, but I think it, presently in San Mateo County, for example, we have a juvenile hall that was built, I believe, to hold 200 kids. And presently, there, I believe, is under 50 boys and a very small number of girls. So it's way less than half of capacity. And one of the problems we face is that it's the old Henry Kaiser slogan of find a need and fill it. When you have a hall that's half empty, either the county has to justify having a building that's half empty or they have to find a way to fill it. The science today, I believe, is clearly showing that detention is actually counterproductive, that the recidivism rate of kids that are in detention is actually much higher than for kids that are dealt with in another way. And so in drawing this to what your third point was as far as community-based organizations, what I believe is the best approach to take with juveniles today in virtually all the cases that you can is to work with community-based organizations in what we call a wraparound type of environment where the kids have a plan and they're set up with support that will help them be successful.
Let's break this down a little bit. First, James Wade, do you agree that therapeutic detention is rarely, if ever, truly therapeutic?
No, because I look at it as a situation where people can learn in a lot of different fashions. And sometimes being locked up for various criminal activities is in the best interest of the minor because they get to understand that there are consequences for their actions, especially with cases where there are very serious offenses that are being committed by the minors. If you reinforce that there are no real consequences for their actions, you are doing them a disservice because then they get into a theory of I can do things and there's going to be very little punishment or consequences for their actions. So I do believe that individuals that are locked up or detained and put into a detention facility do learn something from that.
Dr. Tanaka, you've got a pretty good background in this area. What do you think? Spare the rod and spoil the child?
No, I'm I think I'm closer to James. As long as there's a 1-2 punch involved there, two steps. One where the kid might be detained for 1 or 2 or 3 weeks, during which time outside programming is set up for the kid. With it could be a number of organizations working with the same kid. So in effect, having what's the schools call an IEP, individual education plan, something like that for a kid who could be released into that kind of programming. But having been inside for a couple of weeks, I think can serve as a very good lesson. You don't want to go back, so maybe you should be taking advantage of all this programming. So that's what I've learned over the years.
So there's really two different things going on in juvenile court. One is pretrial and one is post-trial or disposition. So if kids are detained, depending on the particular case, the seriousness of the case prior to adjudication, that would allow for what Dr. Tanaka is talking about. But if you look at what happens in our county to kids that are going into juvenile hall, they're getting a very poor education. They're a vast majority or a large number of the kids in our juvenile hall are special education kids that are not getting the type of special education that they need, so that when they come out of juvenile hall, they are not, they may have learned a lesson, they may have learned their consequences, but they have not been given any building blocks to help them actually succeed. And the other factor is the number of kids involved with mental health issues where they're not getting treated in the juvenile hall facility. So again, whether they're 6 months or 2 weeks or whatever, when they come out, they're further behind in school. They've not received counseling that they need. And it's hard for – because a lot of the juvenile laws that were in place that led to a large number of children being incarcerated was fear-driven by politicians, in other words, in terms of crime. And I'm not saying there isn't crime that juveniles commit, and I'm not saying victims and citizens don't need to be protected. But in the long run, they're going to be better protected by children that are made complete rather than children that are put into a system where when they come out, they're worse or no better than when they came in.
Well, however, it's a situation, it's catch-22, because a lot of the individuals that initially come into the system are individuals that weren't working properly when they were in the community. They weren't going to school. They were truant from classes. They had other issues. It may be the mental health. It may be substance abuse. It may be a lot of different avenues for issues and problems in their lives. One of the things that happens in juvenile hall is that there are assessments that are done by the probation department to make determinations as to some of the needs of the individuals that come before the court. So it also is a benefit to have some of these individuals that are in a detention facility because they can be looked at and evaluated by medical people, mental health people, and the probation department to make a determination as to what might be the most appropriate way to handle these minors.
Now, in a non-emergency situation, isn't that done anyway? It's just not done as rapidly if they're out of custody?
That's true. But furthermore, and I think James would agree with me on this, that presently in our system, even if those things are identified, there's little or no aftercare for these kids that get out of the hall, and particularly ones that have done a fairly long period of time in the hall. A lot of them are given what they call time and terminate. So they're given the time. They may be addressing what their needs are, but the probation department doesn't provide the aftercare that is really what's necessary to give these kids a chance to succeed. And I've brought up this many times with the probation chief in terms and using an example. You have a kid, and let's take someone that's maybe not even put in the hall initially, but put on probation, and one of the conditions is you go to school. And, you know, the probation officer then gets a report that Johnny hasn't gone to school now for 3 days. So the probation officer calls Johnny on the phone and says, you better go to school, I'm not going to violate you. And that happens three or four times, and finally Johnny's just not going to school. So the probation officer files a probation violation. Now Johnny's in the hall. So now we're starting on that road. And it seems to me it would be way more effective if the probation office on the first go-round would call Johnny in and try to get to the reason why Johnny's not going to school. And it may be he's not going because he's being bullied. It may be he's not going because he doesn't have an alarm clock. It may be that he's working late at night, or it may be he's a gang member and he doesn't want to go to school. But our probation department operates too much like a police force and not enough like a help to these kids to help them, because a lot of these children don't have parents that for whatever reason are providing the type of supervision or direction that parents should be giving. And that's the whole purpose of having a probation officer. And my position is, in our county, that type of treatment is missing.
Yeah. Well, I can't agree with the statement that our probation officers are acting more like police officers, because of the fact that our probation officers give individuals, the minors, a number of opportunities to quote unquote fail if that's what they're going to do. I agree with one thing Rick said, that probation officers should immediately upon the first violation have the minor brought into their office and determine what the reason is for their continued violation of probation. They shouldn't be getting 2, 3, 4 breaks before they are brought before the court and made to address whatever the issue is.
So one thing that I think you could agree on is early intervention may be the key. And whether it's a matter of leniency or a matter of being stricter, the reality is we need to address the behavior early so that before somebody's gone out and broken into cars or broken into houses, we're really addressing the road that they're heading down, that they're heading into trouble, and salvaging an individual.
Well, and one thing our probation department, I think, does pretty well is early intervention with first-time offenders. And they do have a lot of community programs that they put – and actually, a lot of this is not even first-time offenders. It's kids that are perhaps in danger of becoming offenders. And they put a lot of money into that to try to keep kids out of the system. My point is that once the kids are in this, those kids that are in the system need that same type of support. And I don't see our probation office really providing that. And I'm speaking in general. There are probation officers, particular probation officers, that do that. But most of what I see is the kids are left on their own with a – in other words, they may be directed to go to counseling. Nobody steps in and helps them to find a counselor or make sure they're going to counseling. And these are kids – for the most part, that need that.
Often from dysfunctional families that don't have that level of support, what the first thing we do is look at them through an institutional lens. Dr. Tanaka, you have obviously quite a bit that you've been trying to get a word in.
I just wanted to say a lot of times what's operating here is a family situation or a cultural situation where the parents may not have the time because both are working. Mm-hmm. Or the language understanding to know what their juvenile child is going through. So this is why I landed more on the side of a little bit of detention early and then wraparound programming, pretty significant programming, if the child is released before trial. Because part of that programming needs to include reprogramming for the parents and so that they don't keep doing things the same way as well. And so if those things happen, then that should contribute a little bit to what you were talking about in a positive way.
We'll shift gears in a moment, but before we do, I want to once again announce it is Call a Lawyer Night. If you have questions for Call a Lawyer, the number that will not place you on the air is 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. This number will not put you on the radio. We have a full house of lawyers standing by to answer your legal questions off the air, both first-time participants and long-time supporters of Call a Lawyer. Regarding tax law and real estate law, we have attorney, real estate broker, CPA Frank Adam from Pacifica. For Lemon Law, patent law, aviation law, arbitration, Ron Rohde of Palo Alto. Criminal law, David Bigelison from San Francisco. If your question involves landlord-tenant, we have Jessica Chilek of San Francisco. Family law, Janet Frankel, certified specialist from San Francisco. And lastly, if you have a bankruptcy or debtor's rights question, we have Leon Baer, certified specialist in bankruptcy law. And again, if you want a consultation that will not place you on the radio, that number is 800-KALW-917. If you're calling for us on the air, please call us with any juvenile delinquency questions you may have. If you have a child in your family that's astray, call us up. Here's some different views on how you might be able to work before your child gets in the system. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us in the studio, 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of San Francisco, 866-798-8255. So we talked a little bit about detention. One thing that wasn't brought up is the sheer cost. And one caller has called in, did not want to speak on the radio, but asked the question, incarcerating juveniles is very expensive. In Los Angeles County, the average cost is $233,000 a year. Why does detention cost so much? And aren't there cheaper, more effective alternatives?
So one of the reasons that detention costs so much is the number of supervisors that are required to watch the children. So the state has rules in terms of how many have to be per child. And then the county itself, the probation department, has its own rules. So probably employment is part of it. These are huge, depending on the counties anyway. Our structure is a pretty large structure. The children have to be fed. Whether there's 40 kids or 200 kids, you're going to have cooks and people that are serving and things of that nature. And so all of these things really drive up the cost. Using community-based programs, a lot of those programs are funded through grants and are funded themselves. So the probation department may contract with them, but it's going to be at a much lesser cost. You have schooling, teachers they have to pay for. And it's all of these things that are incredibly expensive for what I feel is not much of a return.
Well, there's also other entities that are in the juvenile facilities that cost also, because a part of the juvenile system deals with the education and having teachers that are there for the minors when they are detained. These are minors that may have been delinquent, not going to school, truant, etc. And this might be the opportunity to get them to buy into schooling. So that is a cost that also is associated with. There are programs and programming that goes on in the juvenile facilities that also assist them, and these are programs that they wouldn't get on the outside. So in that cost, there are a lot of different things that are encompassed in the juvenile hall, all for the benefit of the minor themselves. And all of these things cost money, like having mental health professionals to address some of those issues, having doctors or nurses at the facilities to deal with any sicknesses and illnesses. Our facility has a dentist that comes in, and some of these minors have never seen a dentist before. So this cost is also associated with it. So there are a lot of benefits that these minors are also getting that is encompassed in that amount of money.
Let me interrupt you. I want to turn it over to Colleen in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Yes, it's a fascinating program, and you were just addressing one of the issues that I feel is of utmost significance, and that is opportunities for education for juveniles. I think it's really hard for juveniles to differentiate a probation officer from the system that they have spent their entire life running away from. And when I heard that, despite that fact, the level of juvenile incarceration has dropped precipitously in San Francisco to the extent that they're moving to two different quarters. And in that statement, they mentioned that it costs somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000 a year to incarcerate a juvenile, which is just shocking to me. I can only see a panoply of places where funds like that could be utilized to really cultivate the abilities and talents of kids that have never had a chance and most frequently have very little social support, parental support for the reasons that you mentioned, and other reasons. And I'd just like to point to one thing. I don't know if you have ever heard of an organization in Los Angeles called Homeboy Industries.
I have. I practiced down there myself for a while.
Yes, it's incredibly successful. And to just give you a very bare-bones description of it, there was a Jesuit who was given his first church right in the middle of the Crips and the Bloods during the real bloodbath years. And he was left with the mandate to do something to help. It was his own mandate. But he felt absolutely compelled to try to help these kids. And what he did is he found, just as you mentioned, that a lot of these kids were actually raising themselves on a park bench. Their parents had abandoned them. They were meth addicts, so on and so forth. And there was just shooting going on night and day. And what he did is he created a community center where kids could come, and one criteria was that they went to school, and he created businesses. First thing he did was to create a bakery, and he taught them how to bake goods. He created a tattoo removal system there where kids could. He said, when kids come in and they have tattoos all over their faces, even if they're rehabilitated, no one's ever going to hire them. And so he created all these pathways, but the most important thing was he created a safe place that was true community, like a family. And they have been immensely successful. And they have now cafes in City Hall in Los Angeles. They have them in the airport, the homegirl bakeries and cafes. And they have they have avoided recidivism at a rate that is unheard of. And in terms of what it costs the state and the county and the city to incarcerate youths, which is just stratospheric, you have somebody that functions on donations. You know, from people that see the merits and the results that he has managed. In fact, he's coming here, I think, in June. But that's one example of what true commitment on a real personal one-to-one family style of concern that is offered to these kids, because they've known nothing but to be institutionalized, and that can become such a chronic. It's like a dog that's always been in a kennel, or a horse that's always been in a stall. They don't even know how to come out of those things.
Especially when you have the gang culture you described that people are often coming out of and then getting incarcerated. Then they get released, and who's there to support them but that same gang, that same gang group? And instead, they have an alternative in the community that's really working with them, that is taking on the role of the family, the parent, and getting them in a more positive direction.
Exactly, and they actually have a silkscreen business also, where they create these T-shirts for sale that are beautiful and positive messaging, as opposed to what you just said. If they go back, you know, they are harassed by the gangs and often killed, you know, if they do not have a source of really solid support like these kids have.
Colina, thank you for your comments. That they've been very insightful. And they really illustrate what some of my guests have been talking about tonight,
Of
the alternative-based methods. The second half hour, I would like to spend more time, instead of talking about incarceration, whether there's a place for it, whether there's no place for it, whether there are certain aspects of it we want to keep, I'd really like to look in the second half hour about whether there are better methods of reaching some of these kids, both in terms not only of turning these kids around, but also, frankly, I don't think any of us want our cars broken into or our homes broken into. If we can reach them and turn them around, they're working for us instead of us working to support them and to replace the things that have gone south. But Colina, thank you for your comments, and thank you for joining us.
This last comment is that what happens most often when the community gets involved is they find out they're not just helping the kids or protecting themselves, they're actually enlarging the scope of their own humanity to such an extent that it's a growth opportunity that they never even imagined. It's life-changing for people when they get involved in helping. So I would just say that as my last comment there.
Colleen, thank you, and thank you for joining us. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And speaking of attorneys that are there to help you with your situation, before we resume our discussions, it is Call a Lawyer Night. We do have attorneys standing by to help you with your legal questions. If you want to call our lawyers that are standing by off the air, not to be joining us on the radio, the number you would call is 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917. Joining us tonight, with patent law, aviation law, lemon law, arbitration, we have Ron Rohde of Palo Alto. To help with your landlord-tenant questions, Jessica Chalik of San Francisco. To help with your tax law, real estate law, Frank Adam of Pacifica. Criminal law, we have David Begelizen of San Francisco. Family law, Janet Frankel, certified specialist out of San Francisco. And for bankruptcy or debtor's rights, Leon Baer, a certified specialist in bankruptcy law. And again, if you want a consultation off the air that's not going to be on the radio, that is going to be a private call, the number to call is 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Jeff Hayden. Here in the studio to me, with me are James Wade, Assistant San Mateo County District Attorney, Richard Halpern, Managing Juvenile Attorney at the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar, Dr. Gregory Tanaka. We're talking about juveniles, adults, young adults, people that we have a way to reach. One of the things that we have not talked about is cultural issues. I want to bring that into the discussion. Again, if you have a question for my guests, and it could be anything related to the areas we're talking, you don't have to join us right where we are in the conversation. Our number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, let us pay the freight. Our number is 866-798-8255. Again, toll free, 866-798-8255. And Dr. Tanaka, maybe you can help me with this. What I'm thinking when I said that about culture, I've had numerous cases where we have a young person who may be an adult, may be a child, but they're from another place. Their family, their entire support network is really rooted in another culture. They're at home speaking another language. And we throw them into the real world, whether it's a workplace or at school, where they're surrounded with people that think very differently. And sometimes those people can guide them astray. How do we reach them? What do you think would? How do you think we deal with that situation?
I'm becoming involved in this. I've been working for about 6 months, helping some community leaders who are Pacific Islanders, so mostly Samoan and Tongan, some Fijians. And yes, the parents, by and large, are from those islands, and most of the kids were born in those islands and brought over at a very young age, or some of them were born here. And so there is actually there are a number of cultural gaps here. One is between the parents and the mainstream culture. The parents often don't interact with the mainstream culture. They don't know what the rules are for schools, for even for the courts, and so they're not basically there to advise their kids on social behavior, at least in the mainstream. Secondly, there's a cultural gap between the parents, who have all these assumptions that are island-based, basically. And the kids who are trying to quickly learn how to become mainstream American. And so there's a lack of understanding between those two generations, and that can exacerbate any other problems that are presented on them by gangs or drug dealers or whoever. And so then there are the kids themselves who are wandering farther and farther away from the mainland culture, I mean, from the island culture, and trying to engage themselves in the mainstream culture. And so they are, I would say, losing their roots slowly. And with that, the ability to feel anchored and whole and connected to other people and to the earth and to the past history. And so that is another cultural area that needs to be tended to.
And yeah. I would think that that would leave this young person feeling pretty vulnerable.
Very vulnerable. I mean, I can give you one example of a case. No names, but the kid is kind of large. A lot of the Pacific Island kids are large for their age. So he was sort of conned into helping a small group attack a guy in a park because he was big and he just was going along with his friends. But this actually is a kid who had no prior record. He was like older teenager. But he did get caught up because of that. And so he was trying to fit into the mainstream, what he felt was the mainstream culture. The parents were not there to understand him. And again, I will say one more time, in this economy, most of these parents, both the parents are working, some of them two or three jobs. So it's a, what's the term, latchkey. The kid is at home by him or herself. So it's very sad. A lot of the economics issue makes things worse, is what I'm saying. But that all fits into the cultural gaps that are operating there. And with the lack of money, there's no, you can't hire babysitters, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Well, and I think this kind of ties into what Dr. Tanaka said earlier about getting the parents involved early. I know from our perspective, my lawyers probably don't know a lot about the Pacific Island culture itself. And so this would be a learning process for them as well as for the parents. In our county, our juvenile hall population is primarily Hispanic. And we do have a little more understanding of the Hispanic culture, but in the Pacific Island culture, we don't. So I truly see a benefit with getting the parents involved where you can.
Yeah. The issue with trying to get the parents involved is one where I've had parents come and talk to me and say, I have tried to teach my child the difference between right and wrong and what they are doing is wrong, but they're not listening and I don't know how to reach them. That's one of the biggest issues when a parent comes to the district attorney's office and talks to a deputy district attorney about getting this help. They don't know how to do it. And in the other end of the spectrum, I have families and parents that come in and say, well, wait a minute, I also have other children that I have to deal with. I can't give all of my energy to just the one that's acting out right now. So it's really a tough situation on the families to deal with a child that now has gone awry when they have other pressures in their life that is impacting on how they can become parents or be parenting individuals.
But that's exactly where Dr. Tanaka comes in describing the group that he's working with, because providing support to these parents with possibly case managers or other people that can deal with their children and help them is also giving help to the parents. Plus, giving some guidance to them in terms of how they can help their child not recidivate.
So we spent the first half hour talking largely about incarceration, whether it works, why it's so expensive, when to use it, when not to use it. What are some other alternatives? Dr. Tanaka, I know you've been working with an organization. Can you give us a little bit of background on their approach?
Our organization is called Anamatangi, Polynesian Voices. It basically refers to the heavenly voice or the royalty, the word Anamatangi. What we basically do is prepare a list of services and a timeline that basically engages the juvenile in all the areas we feel the juvenile has been short in. So we begin, the first thing we do is we study the kid's family background. and educational performance. Has the kid been missing school a lot? What are the grades like, et cetera, et cetera? Then based on that study, quick study, we design an outline, a weekly outline for each kid. I will give you one example. This one kid who's involved in a robbery, we have the parents taking a parenting class once a week to teach them about the courts, about the education system, and the fact that they may or may not be aware of that their kid is even going to school or not. Yeah. We have what's called social emotional counseling by a reverend who's also of the same ethnic background. And then we're taking the kid twice a week to a computer class that's free, teaching him coding and how to design. Eventually, he'll be designing programming, and he loves that. We have him taking ukulele lessons twice a week for free. Again, this is, we have community members doing this. And then I'm teaching him twice a week about leadership and research, so that eventually this juvenile can be part of a larger group of kids we will be taking into churches to research the needs, the unmet needs of the Polynesian community in East Palo Alto. So that these kids are going to be taught how to use research to find out what needs are and then go after grant money to address those needs. So we want to replace, I think it's very important I say this, we want to replace this feeling of being a victim and being always on the losing end and not knowing what's going on, not being provided for, with a sense of agency where the kids can start to take control over and make their lives better. And so that's, maybe that sounds theoretical, but this is kind of what we're trying to do, and it's the kids are catching on. They want to learn about how to be leaders. They want to learn about how to think critically, how to do long-range planning, strategic thinking, how to write grant proposals, et cetera. So this is a kind of wraparound programming that Richard was referring to earlier. And so I'm here to say it's working.
But there are also programs in the juvenile hall, in the juvenile system, that can do the same thing and that do the same things. Like, we have a girls program that where if girls are incarcerated for a period of time, they have mentors, they have counselors, they go to, they could take classes to get their GED and or get a diploma. Some of them go to this thing called Project Change, which is in conjunction with a couple of our community colleges and the College of Notre Dame, where they can go and they can take these college classes and they go with a mentor who monitors their activity. So there are these programs to help uplift the minors when they are incarcerated or in detention in San Mateo County.
So I would agree with James about the girls program. To me, that's the one program in San Mateo County that appears to be working. But those things are not offered to the boys. Whatever programming they have in the hall, some of which is good, ends when they're released from the hall. With the girls program, the girls spend some time in custody, and then there's a huge aftercare program with them, which is exactly the type of thing that Dr. Tanaka and I have been talking about, which is really kind of a wraparound type of treatment. For the boys in the hall, many of them, when they're released, like I said earlier, they're given time and terminate, which means they're not even on probation when they get out. They're just given their time and let out. The level of education that they get in the hall is particularly the special education, kids with special education needs, is taking, they have a situation, as James mentioned, where they have a captive audience. And the education, the level of education they're getting is not preparing them to go to school on the outside. So I don't think, from what I see in our county, you can say that there is programming in the hall that then continues, other than the FLY program, which a few of the kids get involved in have a component outside of custody. But what the kids are, they're put in the hall, then they're released, and they're pretty much left on their own to fill these hours in the day that Dr. Tanaka is referring to, you know, that he's filling the void of. So that, to me, it's looking at the small picture, which is how much these programmings cost now. We're avoiding looking at the big picture, which if you can prevent these children from becoming adult criminals, you're saving a lot more money in the long run.
And I think the area where you might disagree, it seems like you all agree that the cost is astronomical. There's lots of reasons for that. It takes a village to raise a child, and if they're incarcerated, that whole village is brought to bear, and we bear all those costs that are otherwise spread in other places. The money, I don't think, is really a subject that we're disagreeing on most. I think the disagreement is really where, when and if to incarcerate, when detention is helpful, really what's going to keep your neighbors from finding that their storefronts are broken into, and what's going to help get people back on track. And I suspect that we'll break into a little further in a moment and maybe find that one size doesn't fit all. And we'll start talking about some of the things these implement. Before we do, time is short, and I do want to give one last time to remind people this is Call a Lawyer Night. If you have questions for our lawyers that are standing by and do not want to be on the air, the number is 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. We have a tax lawyer, real estate lawyer, Frank Adam, patent law, aviation law, lemon law, Ronald Rohde, criminal law, David Bigelizen, landlord-tenant law, Jessica Chilek, family law, Janet Frankel, for bankruptcy law, debtor's rights, Leon Bayer. Again, if you want a consultation, that's off the air, 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. One of the terms that you used earlier, I think two of you used this term, was a wraparound program. That may not be familiar to a lot of our listeners. What is a wraparound program?
So a wraparound program is what Dr. Tanaka described as his program does, although it can be in many forms. It's where you take a number of different types of groups, and mental health, education, having a case manager, whether it be ukulele lessons or boxing or whatever, and that you basically you wrap your arms around this child. That's where the phrase comes from, and deal with the specific needs of the child and fill those needs. And it involves a great part of filling those hours in the day, number one, and number two, providing a place for them where they're safe. And the caller that you had earlier, the program she was describing, would be an example of a wraparound program. They're giving them job training, education, and this community center where they can go. And I'm sure in that community center, gang membership ends at the door. In other words, whoever's in there, it's a safe haven, basically. And so it's taking all of those different things and individualizing them to a child so that they have this support system on the outside.
A caller called in with another question, not to be heard on the air, the caller, but they do want their question asked. It sounds like between you, you've all described a lot of great programs that exist in different parts of California. In Los Angeles, they have Homeboy Industries. In San Mateo County, they have the Anamatangi Polynesian Voices program. There's all kinds of great programs in different places. Why can't a model program be created that's applied across the board? Why is it such a piecemeal effort? And is it expected that with a piecemeal effort, it leads to inconsistent results?
Well, one of the problems I've been trying to work on in our county is that there is no central place that takes the community organizations and really applies them to an individual. So San Mateo County has a tremendous number of community organizations for children. I've gone to the probation department sponsors every year a fair where all of the community organizations get together in a room and pass out flyers and whatnot. And there's a huge number of support groups for whatever, LGBT youths, parents, children with incarcerated parents. There's a huge number, but there is no central clearinghouse. So you have all these community organizations working separately, and there's nobody in probation that coordinates that so that it's a working program. And I'm not even sure there's a central place that they can actually track every program that's in San Mateo County. So it's a disconnect, basically.
Not even a listserv that these people could join into to communicate with one another.
I have heard talk of them working on that, but it's been 2 or 3 years, and I still haven't seen that come into existence. And that's step number one, is putting together a listserv or one central place you could perhaps go online and find out what support organizations there are, depending on what the needs of the child are. The problem is, every child has different needs, and so you can't generalize just one big program that is going to fit all, because that doesn't work.
Even without having one program for all the different children, any reason that we couldn't have one program that fits all the different localities?
Well, that's very difficult, because somebody has got to take the first step to make this evaluation. And who is going to do that evaluation to make the determination of what programs are appropriate for the specific minors? Minors will have different needs and different ways in which to have those needs met. So it's the first step has to be somebody who can make that evaluation to determine what are the best programs for this minor. And that's what our probation department attempts to do once the minors are detained or incarcerated. They're trying to figure out what are the best programs and what are the needs of this minor so that they can be addressed.
There is a program dealing with two sections of San Mateo County that is being funded by the county manager's office that's targeted South San Francisco and Redwood City, one particular neighborhood in Redwood City. And what they're doing with that group is trying to identify in those communities the programs. And what they've involved, basically, is everybody, all the partners they think are necessary, including the police, with the idea of avoiding incarceration of the children and trying to find other ways to deal with them. And without having the police buy into that, it doesn't work at all. And my understanding is that's working very well. But that's basically a start. Those two neighborhoods were picked because of high incidence of juvenile offenses in those two neighborhoods. But that is a start in terms of then you're putting it to the needs of a particular community, as opposed to, you know, the needs of kids in Atherton are going to be different than the needs of the kids in San Mateo. And so that's what that group is trying to focus on. James and I both were involved with the part of the planning of that.
As we're nearing the end of the hour, I wanted to give everybody a minute or a minute and a half for any last-minute comments you have, if you want to sum up. Who would like to start? I'm seeing everybody volunteering, everybody else. Mr. Wade, how would you like to start?
What I have to say with regards to the juvenile incarceration is there always is going to be a balance when you're talking about juvenile incarceration, because the district attorney's office, we have to balance the rights of the minor against the rights of the victim. And we're trying to make a determination as to what's in the best interest of the minor, but what is also in the best interest of society. Those things sometimes can be diametrically opposed, but sometimes we can actually come to a agreement as to what's in the best interest of the minor that will also protect the society. So that's what we're trying to get to, that balance.
That was pretty fast for about 90 seconds. Who would like to go next?
I'll go next. The science today is pointing to incarceration as not being beneficial for children, and that it also is not beneficial for society, in that the science is showing that the recidivism rates for kids that are incarcerated, as well as the harm that is done to those kids, is outweighed by what the results are if other type of programming, such as the community programming I've been describing, occurs. And nobody is saying, let's stop and, not lock up kids. This has to be done in a way where it's looked at and the alternatives are provided. But it's where the science is going today as far as the value of incarceration of juveniles.
Dr. Tanaka?
I think it comes down to funding. And whether it's funding from the county or at the city level or state level or federal, it would be nice to have set aside funding for this area of developing wraparound services and individualized plans similar to the school's individualized education plan, IEP, for each offender, each child who's been arrested pre-trial at that level, and just try to get an understanding of what's going on there and deal with that with wraparound services. So I would like to see some wraparound services legislation, which, if done well, will replace and bring down the costs that are put into the detention homes. That would be my guess. And so I think overall it would have a lot of benefits for the kids, for the families, and also it will reduce our budget. If it's $230,000 a year per kid, in L.A. County, it's probably something similar to that here. That's really expensive. So, but boy, if we had even half that much for each kid, we could do a lot for the kids we're working with now. And we're underfunded.
And unfortunately, that's going to be the last words we hear tonight, is we're underfunded. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our guests tonight have been Rick Halpern, the Managing Juvenile Attorney at the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar Association, James Wade, Assistant San Mateo County District Attorney, and Dr. Gregory Tanaka, co-founder of Anamatangi Polynesian Voices, community-based organization created to teach language and culture revitalization to Polynesian youth in East Palo Alto. I'd like to thank each of you for joining us. We've also been running our Call a Lawyer Night tonight with Frank Adam of Pacifica, Ron Rohde of Palo Alto, David Bigelison of San Francisco, Jessica Chilek of San Francisco, Janet Frankel of San Francisco, and Leon Bayer of Los Angeles. And again, my thanks to each of those lawyers that have been there working silently in the background, taking your calls and helping people out. Our thanks to those lawyers for sharing their time and insights with all of our callers. Next week, we may revisit the issue of bail, an issue we discussed in May of last year. Should we still have cash bail or abolish cash bail? What would a successor program look like? For tonight, our thanks to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr, and most of all, our thanks to you for listening. I'm Jeff Hayden. Thank you, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.